procedure developed and perfected, then classified. Military use or something. Murat said,
But the civilian guardians of the wheel of the public felt differently.
I think I'm remembering Carter was president. Both our combined nations made it a security priority, shutting it down. Our old NSA, your old C-7, with the RCMPs, bright red jackets and hats with wide brims. In the 1970s, still on horses. Steeply held his mouth of the purse half up to the faint lights of Tucson, peering for something. I recall they went in directly, as in guns drawn, boomed the doors, dismantled the labs. Mercy killed dolphins and goats. Olders disappeared somewhere. Murat's slow circular gesture.
Your point finally is Canadians also. We would choose dying for this, the total pleasure of a passive goat.
Steeply turned, fiddling with an emery board. But you don't see a more specific analogy with the entertainment? Murat tongued at the inside of his cheek.
You are saying the entertainment is somehow optical stimulation of the P-terminals? A way to bypass Briggs electrodes for orgasm and massage pleasures?
The dry rasp of the emery-ing a nail. All I'm saying is analogy. A precedent in your own nation.
As our nation is the Quebec nation. Manitoba is...
I'm saying that if he could get past the blind desire for harm against the U.S., your Monsieur Fortier might be induced to see just what it is he's proposing to let out of the cage. His training was such that he could emery without watching the procedure. For Steepley's most effective interviewing tactic was this long looking down into the face without emotion of any kind. For Murat felt more uncomfortable not knowing whether Steepley believed a thing than if Steepley's emotion of face showed he did not believe. Then tonight, at the prospect of boiled hot dogs, the two newest residents had pulled the typically standard new resident Princess and P special food issue thing. The new today girl, Amy J., just sits there on the vinyl couch shaking like an aspen and having people bring her coffee and light her gaspers, and with just short of a, like, helpless victim please coddle sign hung around her neck, now claiming red dye number 4 gives her cluster migraines. Gately gives this girl, like, a week, tops, before she's a vapor trail back to the Xanax. She has that look.
199.
And the weirdly familiar but southernish-sounding girl, Joelle Van D., with the past-believing bod and the linen face announcing she was a vegetarian and would rather eat a bug than even get downwind of a boiled frank. But in an incredible move, Pat M. has asked Gately, at like 1,800 hours, to blast down to the Purity Supreme down in Alston and pick up some eggs and peppers so the two new delicate-tummied newcomers can make themselves quiche or whatever. To Gately's way of thinking, this looks like catering to just the sort of classic addict's claim of special uniqueness that it's supposed to be Pat's job to help break down. The Joel VD girl seems to have, like, inordinate immediate weight and pet status with Pat, who's already making noises about exempting the girl from the menial job requirement, and wants Gately to look for some kind of weird big red soda water tonic for the girl, who's apparently still dehydrated. It's sure a long way from making somebody chew feldspar. Gately has long since quit trying to figure Pat Montesian out. It's a weird weather evening, both thundering and spitting snow. Gately had finally become able to distinguish genuine thunder from the Enfield sounds of ATH-SCME fans and EWD catapults, this after 9 months of wearing a Goodwill rain slicker every morning on the 0430 Green Line. One of the possible weak spots in Gately's AA recovery program of rigorous personal honesty is that once he's jammed himself into a black-as-water Aventura and watched the spoiler throb as he turns over the carnivorous engine, etc., he often finds himself taking a little bit less of a direct route to a given innit errand site than he probably could. If he had to come right down to the heart of the issue, he likes to cruise around town in Pat's car. He's able to minimize the suspicious time any particular bit of extra cruising adds to his errands by basically driving like a lunatic, ignoring lights, cutting people off, scoffing at one-ways, veering wildly in and out, making pedestrians drop things and lunge curbward, leaning on a horn that sounds more like an air raid siren. You'd think this would be judiciously insane in terms of not having a license and facing a no-license jail bit anyway. But the fact is that this sort of on-the-way-to-the-ER-with-a-passenger-in-labor driving doesn't usually raise so much as an eyebrow among Boston's finest, since they have more than enough other stuff to attend to in these troubled times. And since everybody else in Metro Boston drives exactly the same sociopathic way, including the finest themselves, so that the only real risk Gately's running is to his own sense of rigorous personal honesty. One cliché he's found especially serviceable with regards to the Aventura issue is that recovery is about progress, not perfection. He likes to make a stately left onto Commonwealth and wait to get out of view of the house's bay window, and then produce what he imagines is a rebel yell and open her up down the serpentine tree-lined boulevard of the avenue as it slithers through bleak parts of Brighton and Alston and past Boston University and toward the big triangular Citgo neon sign and the Back Bay. He passes the Unexamined Life Club, where he no longer goes, at 1800 hours, already throbbing with voices and bass under its ceaseless neon bottle, and then the great gray numbered towers of the Brighton Projects, where he definitely no longer goes. Scenery starts to blur and distend at 70 kilometers per hour. Commonwealth Avenue splits Enfield, Brighton, Alston from the downscale north edge of Brookline on the right. He passes the meat-colored facades of anonymous Brookline tenements, Father and Son Market, a dumpster nest, Burger King's, Blanchard's Liquors, an Interlace outlet, a land barge alongside another dumpster nest, corner bars and clubs, Play It Again Sam's, Harper's Ferry, Bunratty's, Ratskeller, Father's First 1 and 2, a CVS, two Interlace outlets right next to each other, the Ellis the Rim Man sign, the Marty's Liquors that they rebuilt like ants the week after it burned down. He passes the hideous Riley's Roast Beef, where the Alston group gathers to pound coffee before commitments. The giant distant Citgo signs like a triangular star to steer by. He's doing 75 kilometers down a straightaway, keeping abreast of an inbound Green Line train ramming downhill on the slightly raised track that splits Commonwealth's lanes into two and two. He likes to match a green train at 75 kilometers, all the way down Commonwealth's Integral V, to see how close he can cut beating it across the tracks at the Brighton Avenue split. It's a vestige. He'd admit it's like a dark vestige of his old, low self-esteem, suicidal thrill behaviors. He doesn't have a license, it's not his car, it's a priceless art object car, it's his boss's car, who he owes his life to and sort of maybe loves. He's on a vegetable run for shattered husks of newcomers just out of detox whose eyes are rolling around in their heads. Has anybody mentioned Gately's head is square? It's almost perfectly square, massive and boxy and mysticetously blunt. The head of somebody who looks like he likes to lower his head in charge. He used to let people open and close elevator doors on his head, break things across his head. The indestructible, in his childhood cognomen, referred to the head. His left ear looks a bit like a prize fighter's left ear. The head's nearly flat on top, so that his hair, long in back but with short Prince Valiant bangs in front, looks sort of like a carpet remnant somebody's tossed on the head and let slide slightly back but stay.
200.
Nobody that lives in these guano-spotted old brown buildings along Commonwealth, with bars on the low floor's windows, ever goes inside, it seems like.
201.
Even in thunder, and little asterisks of snow. All kinds of olive Spanish and puke-white Irish are on every corner, bullshitting and trying to look like they're just out there waiting for something important, and drinking out of tall boys wrapped tight in brown bags. A strange nod to discretion, the bags, wrapped so tight the outline of the cans can't be missed. A shore boy, Gatelead never used a paper bag around street corner cans. It's like a city thing. The Aventura can do 80 kilometers per hour in third gear. The engine never strains or whines. Just eventually starts to sound hostile. It's how you know to hurt your hip and shift. The Aventura's instrument panel looks more like the instrument panel of a military aircraft. Something's always blinking and indicating. One of the blinking lights is supposed to tell you when to shift. Pat has told him to ignore the panel. He loves to make the driver's side window go down and rest his left elbow on the jamb like a cabbie. He's caught behind a bus whose big square ass is in both lanes and he can't get around it in time to beat the train across the split, though. And the train crosses in front of the bus with the blast of its farty-sounding horn, and what Gately sees as a kind of swagger to its jiggle on the street-level track. He can see people bouncing around inside the train, holding onto straps and bars. Below the split on Commonwealth, it's Boston University, Kenmore and Fenway, Berklee School of Music. The sit-go sign's still off in the distance ahead. You have to go a shocking long way to actually get to the big sign, which everybody says is hollow, and you can get up inside there and stick your head out in a pulsing neon sea, but nobody's ever personally been up in there. Arm out like a hack's arm, Gately blasts through BU country, as in backpack and personal stereo and designer fatigues country. Soft-faced boys with backpacks and high hard hair and seamless foreheads. Totally lineless, untroubled foreheads like cream cheese or ironed sheets. All the storefronts here are for clothes or TP cartridges or posters. Gately's had lines on his big forehead since he was about 12. It's here he especially likes making people throw their packages in the air and dive for the curb. BU girls, who look like they've eaten nothing but dairy products their whole lives. Girls who do step aerobics. Girls with good combed, long, clean hair. Non-addicted girls. The weird hopelessness at the heart of lust. Gately hasn't had sex in almost 2 years. At the end of the Demerol, he physically couldn't. Then, in Boston AA, they tell you not to. Not in your first year clean, if you want to be sure to hang in. But they, like, omit to tell you that after that year's gone by, you're going to have forgotten how to even talk to a girl, except about surrender and denial and what it used to be like out there, in the cage. Gately's never had sex sober yet, or danced, or held somebody's hand except to say, the Our Father, in a big circle. He's gone back to having wet dreams at age 29. Gately's found he can get away with smoking in the Aventura if he opens the passenger window, too, and makes sure no ashes go anywhere. The crosswind through the open car is brutal. He smokes menthols. He'd switched to menthols at 4 months clean because he couldn't stand them, and the only people he knew that smoked them were niggers, and he'd figured that if menthols were the only gaspers he let himself smoke, he'd be more likely to quit. And now, he can't stand anything but menthols, which Calvin T. says are even worse for you because they got little bits of asbestos-y shit in the filter and whatnot. But Gately had been living in the little male live-in staffer's room down in the basement, by the audio payphone and tonic machines for like 2 months before it turned out the health guy came and inspected and said all the big pipes up in that room's ceiling were insulated in ancient asbestos that was coming apart and asbestosizing the room, and Gately had to move all his shit and the furniture out into the open basement, and guys in white suits with oxygen tanks went in and stripped everything off the pipes and went over the room with what smells like it was a flamethrower. Then hauled the decayed asbestos down to EWD in a welded drum with a skull on it. So Gately figures menthol gaspers are probably the least of his lung worries at this point.
You can get to the Starro 500 off Comm Ave below Kenmore via this long, twiny, overpass-shadowed road that cuts across the fens.
202.
Basically, the Starro 500 is an urban express route that runs along the bright blue chalk all the way along Cambridge's spine. The Charles is vivid even under gloomy, thundering skies. Gately has decided to buy the newcomer's omelette stuff at Bread and Circus in Inman Square, Cambridge. It will explain the delay and will be a subtle nonverbal stab at unique dietary requests in general. Bread and Circus is a socially hyper-responsible, overpriced grocery full of Cambridge Green Party granola crunchers, and everything's like microbiotic and fertilized only with organic genuine llama shit, etc. The adventurer's low driver's seat and huge windshield afford your thinking man maybe a little more view of the sky than he'd like. The sky is low and gray and loose and seems to hang. There's something baggy about the sky. It's impossible to tell whether snow is actually falling or whether just a little snow that's already fallen is blowing around. To get to Inman Square, you veer over three lines to get off the Starro 500 on Prospect Street's Ramp of Death, and slalom between the sinkholes and go right, north, and take Prospect through Central Square, and all the way north through heavy ethnicity up almost into Somerville. Inman Square, too, is someplace Gately rarely goes anymore because it's in the Cambridge's little Lisbon, heavily Portuguese, which means also Brazilians in the antiquated bell-bottoms and flare-colored leisure suits they've never let go of, and where there are disco-ized Brazilians, can cocaine and narcotics ever be far away? The district's Brazilians are another solid rationale for driving at excessive rates of speed for Gately. Plus, Gately's solidly pro-American, and north of Central Square's clot and snarl, Prospect Street's a copless straight shot through eerily alien lands. Billboards in Spanish, plaster Madonnas in fenced-in front yards, intricately laced grape arbors looking seized and clutched at now by networks of finger-thick, bare woody vines. Ads for lottery tickets in what isn't quite Spanish. All the houses gray. More bright plastic Madonnas and nunnish get-ups on peeling front porches. Stores and bodegas and low-suspension cars triple-parked. An all-out, full-cast creche-type scene hung from a second-floor balcony. Clotheslines hanging between houses. Gray houses in rows squished right up next to each other in long rows with tiny, toy-strewn yards. And tall, the houses, like being squished in from either side, distends them. A couple Canadian and Nook-owned stores mashed in here and there, between the propinquous Spanish three-deckers, looking subjugated and exiled and etc. The street, shitty with litter and holes, indifferent drainage, big-ass girls stuffed like stuffed sausage into cigarette jeans, in always trios, in the twilight, with that weird blonde brown hair Portuguese girls dye their hair to. A store in good old English advertising, chickens, fresh killed, daily. Ryle's Jazz Club's upscale pub-type bar. Guys in tweed caps and their briar pipes in mouths and angles, taking all day on a pint of warm stout. Gately's always thought dark beer tasted like cork. An intriguing single-decker medical-looking building, with a sort of tympanum over the smoked glass door, with an ad that says, "Complete destruction of confidential records," that Gately's always wanted to poke the old head in and have a look at what on earth they might be up to in there. Little Portuguese markets with food in there you can't even tell what species it's from. One set a Portuguese takeout at Inman Square's East End. A coke whore tried to get Gately to eat something that had tentacles. He had a sub instead. Gately now simply blows through Inman,
heading for B and C, over on the upscale northwest side nearer to Harvard. Every light suddenly green and kind. The Aventura's ten-cylinder backwash raising an odd little tornado of discorded ad leaflets and glassine bags and corporate snack bags and a syringe's husk and filterless Gasper butts and general crud and a flattened millennial fizzy cup, like from a stand, which whirls in his exhaust, the tornado of waste does, moving behind him as the last pearly curve of the sun through baggy clouds is eaten by the countless Sancta something, and then whitewashed wasp church roofs finials farther west, near Harvard at 60 kilometers, but sustained in its whirl by the strong west breeze as the last of the sun goes, and a blue-black shadow quietly fills the canyon of Prospect, whose streetlights don't work for the same municipal reasons the street is in such crummy repair. And one piece of the debris Gately's raised and set spinning behind him, a thick, flattened MF cup, caught by a sudden gust as it falls, twirling, is caught at some aerodyne's angle and blown spinning all the way to the storefront of one Entetoile Entertainment.
203.
On the street's east side, and hits, its waxed bottom making a clunk, hits the glass pane in the locked front shop door with a sound, for all the world, like the rap of a knuckle. So that in a minute a burly bearded thoroughly Canadian figure, in one of those Canadianly inevitable checked flannel shirts, appears out of the dim light in the shop's back room and wipes its mouth on first one sleeve, then the other, and opens up the front door with a loud hinge squeak and looks around a bit, namely, for who knocked, looking not overly pleased at being interrupted at what his sleeves betray as a foreign supper. And also, below that harried expression, looking edgy and emotionally pale, which might explain the X of small arms ammo belts across his checked chest, and the rather absurdly large 44 revolver tucked and straining in the waistband of his jeans. Lucien Antitoy's equally burly partner and brother, Bertrand, currently still back there in the little back room, where they sleep on cots with serious weaponry underneath, and listening to CQBC radio, and scheme, and smoke killer USA hydroponic dope, and cut and mount glass, and sew flags, and cook over Sterno in L.L. Bean upscale survivalist cookware. He's back there, eating habitant soup au pois and bread, with bread and circus molasses, and some sort of oblong blue-veined patties of a meat your thinking American wouldn't even want to try to identify. Bertrand's forever laughing in Quebecois and telling Lucien he looks forward with humorous anticipation to the day Lucien forgets to check the big Colt safety before he jams it into the waistband of his pants and goes lumbering around the shop in his hobnail boots, making every reflective and blown glass item in the place tinkle and clink. The unautomatic revolver, it is a souvenir of affiliation. Once or twice during work of affiliation with the separatist, anti-ONANFLQ, they are, for the most part, not a very terrifying insurgent cell, the Entetoile. More or less loners, self-contained, a monomitotic cell, eccentric and borderline incompetent, protected gently by their late regional patron, M. Guillaume Duplessis, of the Gaspé Peninsula, spurned by FLQ after Duplessis' assassination, and also ridiculed by the more malignant anti-ONAN cells. Bertrand Entetoile is in charge, the brains of the outfit, pretty much by default, since Lucien Entetoile is one of the very few natives of Notre-Dépas ever who cannot understand French, just never caught on, and so has very limited veto powers, even when it comes to such harebrained Bertrand schemes as hanging a sword-stemmed fleur-de-lis flag from the nose of a USA Civic War Heroes Boylston Street statue, when it would simply be cut down by bored ONAN-ite Chien-Courant gendarme the next morning, or taping bricks to the return postage-paid solicitation cards, a Saint-Christie-Gentel's CUSP party. or fashioning astroturf doormats with a likeness of Saint-Christy Gentel on them, and distributing them gratis to home supply outlets throughout their insurgency grid. Puerile, and on the whole rather sad little gestures, that M. Duplessis would have interdicted with a merry laugh and a friendly hand on Bertrand's bowling ball of a shoulder. But M. Duplessis had been martyred. An assassination only, O.N.A.N. would be stupid enough to believe, command would be stupid enough to believe, was merely an unfortunate burglary and mucus mishap. And Bertrand Antetoit, after Duplessis' death and F.L.Q.'s rejection, left to his own conceptual devices for the first time since their all-terrain vehicle was packed with quality Van Buskirk of Montreal, exotic reflective glasswares and glass-blowing hardware, and broom, and ordnance, and survivalist cookware, and hip postcards, and black leather gag soap, and cheesy old low-demand interlaced third-grid cartridges, and hand buzzers, and fraudulent but seductive X-ray spectacles, and they were sent through the remains of Provincial Honor Road 55, U.S. 91, in protective garb they'd shed and buried, just south of the Convexity's Bellows Falls, Vermont, O.N.A.N.I.T.E. checkpoint, sent as a kind of primitive two-celled organism to establish a respectable front and to abet more malignant cells and to insurge and terrorize in small, sad, anti-experialist ways. Now, Bertrand has shown a previously Duplessis-restrained flair for stupid wastes of time, including this branching out into harmful pharmaceuticals as an attack on the fiber of New England's youth, as if the USA youth were not already more than fiberless enough, in Lucien's mute opinion. Bertrand had actually been credulous enough with a wrinkled, long-haired person of advanced years in a paisley Nehru jacket, also of great age, and a puzzling cap with a skeleton playing at the violin emblazoned upon it on the front, wearing also the most stupid-appearing small round wire spectacles with salmon-colored lenses, and also continually forming the letter of V with fingers of his hand and directing this letter of V at Bertrand and Lucien. Bertrand felt the gesture was a subtle affirmation of solidarity with patriotic struggle everywhere and stood for Victoire. But Lucien suspected a USA obscenity, laughingly flashed at persons who would not comprehend its insult, just as one of Lucien's sadistic École Spéciale tutors back in Saint-Antoine had spent weeks in second form teaching Lucien to say Vacher Putain, which he, the tutor, claimed meant, Look, Maman, I can speak French and thus finally express my love and devotion to you. Bertrand had been starry-eyed enough to agree to barter the person an antique blue lava lamp and a lavender-tinged apothecary's mirror for 18 unexceptional-looking and old lozenges the long-haired old person had claimed in a jumble of West Swiss-accented French were 650 milligrams of a trop-formidable, harmful pharmaceutical, no longer available and guaranteed to make one's most hair-raising psychedelic experience look like a day on the massage tables of a Basel Hot Springs Resort, throwing in as well a kitchen can waste bag filled with crusty old mossy boot and leg read-only cartridges, sans any labels, that appeared to have been stored in a person's rear yard and then run through a gaseous dryer of clothes, as if Lucien did not have already more than plenty of crusty old cartridges, which Bertrand removed from interlaced dumpsters or was cheated in barters for, and brought back to the shop for Lucien's job to view, and label, and organize the cartridges for storing, and were never bought except the occasional cartridge in Portuguese or pornographical. And the aged person had flopped off in his cap and sandals with a lamp and an apothecary's mirror, to which Lucien had been personally much attached, particularly to the lavender mirror, flashing this covert obscenity of V. And with smiles, urging the brothers to write their name and address on the palm of their hands with the drenching sweat-proof ink, before they dropped any of the so-called tu sais quoi, if they were going to be the persons who ingested these lozenges. The front door squeaks loudly of the hinge, and Lucien recloses it and drives the bolt home. Squeak. The upper hinge squeaks, no matter the oil, as the shop drives Lucien crazy by becoming again dusty each time the door is opened to the street's grit. And from the dust of the alley, with so many dumpsters behind the back room, which Bertrand refuses not to open the iron service door of, to spit. The squeak functions in the place of a customer bell, however. The front knock of the closed door clearly is once again big-bottomed Brazilian children playing at unassuming pranks. He does not pull the window shade, but he does grab the stout, trusty homemade broom he sweeps the shop all day with, and stands there, chewing anxiously the nail of a thumb, looking out. Lucien Antitoire enjoys standing at the door's glass pane and looking blankly out, at the light snow of dust bright against the blue-shadowed twilight eating the American street outside. The door continues to squeak faintly, even after he's driven home the bolt. He can stand here, happily, for hours, leaning on the sturdy broom he'd carved from a snow-snapped limb as a boy, during the Gaspé's terrible blizzards of Quebec of AD 1993, and bound broom corn onto, and sharpened the tip of, as a sort of domestic weapon, even then, before O.N.A.N.ite experialist impost made any sort of struggle or sacrifice remotely necessary, as a silent boy, keenly interested in weapons and ammunitions of all the different sorts, which, along with the size thing, helped with the teasing. He could, and does, stand here for hours, complexly backlit, transparently reflected, looking at alien traffic and commerce. He has that rare spinal appreciation for beauty in the ordinary that nature seems to bestow on those that have no native words for what they see. Squeak. The visual bulk of the shoproom of Antitoire Entertainment is devoted to glass. They have set curved and planar mirrors at studied angles whereby each part of the room is reflected in every other part, which flusters and disorients customers and keeps haggling to a minimum. In a sort of narrow-fashioned corridor behind one gauntlet of angled glass is their stock of gags, notions, ironic postcards, and unironic sentimental greeting cards as well.
204.
Flanking another are shelf after shelf of used and bootleg interlace and independent and even homemade digital entertainment cartridges. In no discernible order, since Bertrand handles acquisition and Lucien's in charge of inventory and order. Nevertheless, once he's viewed it even once, he can identify any used cartridge in stock and will point it out to the rare customer with the sharpened white wood tip of his homemade broom. Some of the cartridges do not even have labels. They're so obscure or illicit. To keep up with Bertrand, Lucien must watch new acquisitions on the small cheap viewer beside the manual cash register as he sweeps the shop with the imposing broom he has loved and kept sharpened and polished and floor fuzz free since adolescence, and when she sometimes imagines he is conversing with, very quietly, telling it to Vachier Poutain in tones surprisingly gentle and kind for such a large terrorist. The viewer screen has something wrong with its definition, and there is a wobble that makes all cartridge performers on the left section of it appear to have Tourette's syndrome. The pornographical cartridges he finds nonsensical and use them in fast-forward to get them over with as quickly as possible. But he knows all but the most recent acquisitions' colors and visual plots, but some still have no labels. He still has not gotten to see and shelve many of the massive assortment Bertrand lugged home and out of the all-terrain vehicle in Saturday's chilling rain. Several old exercise and film cartridges a small Back Bay Tel entertainment outlet was discarding as outdated. Also, there were one or two Bertrand claimed he had picked up literally on the street downtown, from the site of the flag-draped Shaw statue, from untended commercial displays, that stupidly contained detachable cartridges anyone could detach and lug home in the rain. The display's cartridges he had immediately viewed, for though they were unlabeled save for a commercialized slogan in tiny raised letters, of Il faut plus compris suivre le bonheur, which to Lucien Antetois signified zilch. Each was stamped also with a circle and arc that resembled a disembodied smile, which made Lucien himself smile and pop them in right away, to find to his disappointment and impatience with Bertrand that they were blank, without even HD static, just as the old rude person's bartered tapes he had removed from the waste bag of their storage for viewing had proved, blank beyond static, to the satisfaction of Lucien's disgust.
205.
Through the door's window, passing headlights illumine a disabled person in a wheelchair, laboring along the rutted walk outside the Portuguese grocery opposite Antetois Entertainment storefront. Lucien forgets he was eating bread with upscale molasses and soup au pois. He forgets he is eating the moment the food's taste leaves his mouth. His mind is usually as clean and transparent as anything in the shop. He sweeps a little, absently, in front of the pane, watching his face's reflection bob against the blackening night outside. Light snow almost is bouncing back and forth between sides of Prospect's Canyon. The broom's bristles say, hush, hush. The tin and static sound of CQBC has been silenced. You can hear Bertrand moving about, rattling some pans and dropping one. And Lucien works his sharp-pointed broom against the chipped Portuguese tile of the non-wood floor. He is a gifted domestic. The best 125-kilo domestic ever, to wear a beard and suspenders of small arms ordnance. The shop, crammed to the acoustic tile ceiling and dustless, resembles a junkyard for anal retentives. He bobs and sweeps, and bobbing shafts of mirror light gleam and dance, backed by night, in the locked door's pane. The figure in the wheelchair still labors at his wheels, but appears, queerly, still to be where he was before, in front of the Portuguese grocery. Moving closer to the pane, so that his face's transparent image fills the glass, and he can now see clearly beyond it, Lucien sees that what it is it's a different figure in a different wheelchair from the one before. This new figure's face, also downcast and queerly masked, laboring around the sidewalk's jagged holes, and that not too far behind this seated figure is yet another figure in a wheelchair coming this way. And as Lucien Antetois twists his head and presses his hairy cheek to the glass of the squeaking door. Except, but now how can a door's upper hinges loudly squeak when the door is tightly closed, and the bolt driven home with the solid snick of a 44 bullet slipped home in the revolver's chamber? Looking due southeast up Prospect, Lucien can see the variegated glints of passing low chassis headlights off a whole long single-file column of polished metal wheels, stolidly turning, being turned by swarthy hands in fingerless wheelchair gloves. Squeak. Squeak. Lucien has been hearing squeaks for several minutes from what he had naively, like the babe, assumed was the door's upper hinge. This hinge does truly squeak.
206.
But Lucien now hears whole systems of squeaks. Slow and soft, but not stealthy squeaks. The squeaks of weighted wheelchairs moving slow, implacable, calm and businesslike, and yet menacing. Moving with the indifference of things at the very top of the food chain. And now, turning, heart loud in his head, can now see, in the carefully placed display mirror's angles, spikes of light off rotary metal rotating at a height above waist level to a huge standing man with broom clutched to barrel chest. There are great quiet numbers of persons in wheelchairs moving in the room with him, in the shop room, moving calmly into position behind waist-high glass counters full of wacky notions. The street outside is flanked on both sidewalks by defiles of wheelchaired, blanket-lapped persons whose faces are obscured by what look like large and snow-dotted leaves. And the shades of the Portuguese grocery have been drawn, and a Ropas sign hung by a circumflex of twine in the pane of the front door. Wheelchair assassins. Lucien has been taught the glyph of a profiled wheelchair with an enormous bone-crossed skull below. It is the worst possible scenario. It is worse than O.N. Aonite Gendarme by far. A.F.R. Whimpering to his broom, Lucien disengages the mammoth colt from his pants and finds that a length of black thread from the denim panel that surrounds his zipper has gotten looped around the barrel's sight blade and comes ripping out with a long high squeak from the pants with the convulsive force of his drawing the weapon, so that his pants split open alongside the zipper, and the force of his mammoth Canadian gut extends the tear all up and down the front, so that the snap unsnaps, and the jeans burst open and fall immediately to his ankles, puddling around his hobnail boots, revealing red union suit underwear beneath, and forcing Lucien to take tiny, undignified shuffling steps frantically toward the back room, as he tries with a thread-snagged colt to cover every piece of fragmented, waist-high motion the mirror's shards of light reveal in the shop room, while scuttling as fast as the fallen jeans allow toward the back room to alert, non-verbally, using the sort of demon-eyed, tongue-protruded, neck-corded, tortured, rigid, bug-eyed face a small child makes when he is playing Le Monstre, to alert Bertrand that they have come. Not Bostonian gendarme, or white-suited O.N. Aonite Chens, but they. Them. Les Assassins de Fauteuil-Laurent. AFRs. The ones who come always in the twilight, implacably squeaking, and cannot be reasoned with or bargained with, feel no pity or remorse, or fear, except a rumored fear of steep hills. And now they're all in here, all over the shoproom like faceless rats, the devil's own hamsters, moving with placid squeaks just beyond view of the shop's mirrored peripheries, regally serene. And Lucien, with the big broom in one hand and the thread-webbed colt in the other, tries to cover his little stepped flight with a thunderous shot that goes high and shatters an angled length planar door mirror, spraying anodized glass, and replaces the reflection of a blanket-lapped AFR wearing a plastic fleur-de-lis with sword-stem mask on his face, with a jagged, stelliform hole, with glittered shards and glass dust in the air all over the place, and the unperturbable squeaks. Squeak, 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 squeak. It is awful. Sounding right through the clatter and tinkle and frantic hobnailed boot falls and through the flying glass, aiming every which way behind him. Lucien bursts almost falling through the curtains, bug-eyed and corded and webbed in thread, to alert Bertrand frantically that the shot had signified AFRs, and to break out the sub-cot weaponry and prepare to bunker for encirclement, only to horrifyingly see the shop's rear service door standing agape in a gritty breeze, and Bertrand still at the card table they use for their supper, used, with pea soup and troubling meat patty still on his ration tray, sitting, squinting, piratically straight ahead, with a railroad spike in his eye. The spike, its tip is both domed and squared, also rusty, and it protrudes from the socket of his brother's former blue right eye. There are maybe about 6 or 9 AFR in here in the drafty back room, silent as ever, seated with motionless wheels, flannel blankets obscuring an absence of the legs. Also, of course, flannel-shirted, masked in synthetic blend heraldic flag irises with flaming transpersonal stems at the chin, and slits for eyes and round, utter holes for mouths. All except for one particular of the AFR, in an unpretentious sport coat and tie, and the worst mask of all, a plain yellow polyresin circle, with an obscenely simple smiley face in thin black lines, who is speculatively dipping a baguette's heel in Bertrand's metal soup cup, and popping the bread into his mask's mouth's cheery hole with an elegantly cerise-gloved hand. Lucien, staring goggle-eyed at the only brother he's ever had, is standing very still, face still unwittingly territoried, the broom at an angle in his hand, the colt dangling at his side, and the long black zipper thread he's pulled from his zipper, caught somehow now, and wrapped around his thumb, and hung trailing on the spotless floor with slack between gun and thumb. His pants wops it around his red woolen ankles when he hears a quick, efficient squeak, and feels from behind a tremendous wallop on the backs of his knees that drives him down to his knees on the floor, the 44 bucking as it discharges by reflex into the wooden pattern Portuguese tile, so that he's down in a supplicant's posture on his red knees, encircled by Fauteuil de Leron, still holding his broom, but now down near the broom corn's wire binding. His face is now of equal height to the yellow, empty, smiling, chewing face of the AFR, as this leader, everything about him radiates pitiless and remorseless command, rotates a right wheel to bring himself about, and with three squeakless rotations, has his hideous blank, black smile within centimeters of Lucien Antetoy's face. The AFR bids him, "Snore, sir," which means nothing to Lucien Antetoy, whose chin has caved and lips are quivering, though his eyes are not what you would call jack-lighted or terrified eyes. Lucien's brother's pierced and rigid profile is visible over the leader's left shoulder. The man still has some soup, sopped bread in his glove's left hand.
"Malheureusement, ton collègue est décédé. Il faisait un excellent soupepois."
He looks amused.
"Non, ou c'était toi, faisait-elle?"
The leader leans forward in the grateful way people who always sit can lean, revealing wiry hair and a small and strangely banal bald spot, and gently removes the hot revolver from Lucien's hand. He engages the safety without having to look at the revolver. Spanish-language music is thinly audible from somewhere up above the alley. The AFR looks warmly into Lucien's eyes for a moment, then with a professionally vicious, backhanded motion, pegs the gun at Bertrand's profiled head, striking Bertrand the side of the head, and Bertrand rocks away, and then toward and forward, and slides forward left off the rickety camping chair, and with a ghastly and moist thump, comes to rest, chairless but upright, his left hip on the floor, the eye's sturdy railroad spike's thick tip caught on the edge of the card table and tilted up as the table tilts downward and cookery slides nautically off and onto the tile, as the weight of Bertrand's large upper body is somehow held by the spike and tilted table. His brother's face is now turned away from Lucien, and his overall posture is of some person crumpled with hilarity or regret, maybe beer, a man overcome. Lucien, who never has apprehended what the safety switch is or where, thinks it's a small miracle that the Colt 44, with its tail of thread, does not discharge again as it wangs off Bertrand's temple and hits the slick tile and slides from sight under a cot. Somewhere in the tall house next door, a toilet flushes, and the back room's pipes sing. The black thread has remained snagged on the Colt's sight blade and in the middle caught somewhere on Bertrand's ear. The other remains also attached to Lucien by a persistent hangnail on his well-gnawed right thumb, so that a black filament still connects the knelt Lucien to his hidden revolver, with a surreal angled turn at the ear of his overcome frère. The happy-masked AFR leader, politely ignoring the fact that Lucien's sphincter has failed them all in the small room, after complimenting them both on the craftsmanship of some of the front's blown glass notions, pulls his velvet gloves tighter and tells Lucien that it has fallen to him, Lucien, to direct their attention without delay to an entertainment item they have come here to acquire. And require this copy-capable item. They are here on business.
N'est pas plaisanté.
This is not the social call. They will acquire this thing, and then iront petra. They have no wish to disturb anyone's repast, but the AFR fears that it is fearfully urgent and key, this master item they now require without delay or dissembly from Lucien. Entend-il? The vigor with which Lucien shakes his head at the leader's meaningless sounds can't help but be misinterpreted, probably. Does this shop have the 585 RPM drive TP somewhere about here for running masters? Same vigorous, negative-looking denial of comprehension. Can a mask's drawn smile widen? From the front of the shop come whole symphonies of squeaks and low, trilled R's, and the sounds of a densely packed area being swiftly dismantled and searched. A few legless, thick-armed men climb the shelves by hand and hang up near the drop ceiling by special climbing equipment and suction cups fitted to their stumps, brown arms busy in the upper shelving, dismantling and searching upside down like obscene, industrious bugs. The outline of Lucien's quivering mouth is being traced by a mammoth-torsoed AFR in a Jesuitical collar, who holds Lucien's own trusty broom inverted and leans in his chair to caress Lucien's full Gaspé Provincial lips. The lips are quivering, with the handle's wicked tip, which is sharply white, whittled free of the sienna glaze of broomstick varnish that patinas the rest of the big stick's length. Lucien's lips are quivering not so much from fear, although there is certainly fear, but not from fear so much as in an attempt to form words.
207.
Words that are not, and can never be words, are sought by Lucien here through what he guesses to be the maxillofacial movements of speech. And there is a childlike pathos to the movements that perhaps the rigid-grinned AFR leader can sense. Perhaps that is why his sigh is sincere. His complaint sincere when he complains that what will follow will be inutile. Lucien's failure to assist will be inutile. There will be no point serviced. There are several dozen highly trained and motivated wheelchair personnel here, who will find whatever they seek and more, anyhow. Perhaps it is sincere. The Gallic shrug and fatigue of the voice through the leader's mask hole, as Lucien's leonine head is tilted back by a hand in his hair, and his mouth opened wide by calloused fingers that appear overhead and around the sides of his head from behind, and jack his writhing mouth open so wide that the tendons in his jaws tear audibly, and Lucien's first sounds are reduced from howls to a natal gargle as the pale, wicked tip of the broom he loves is inserted, the wood piney-tasting, then white, tasteless pain, as the broom is shoved in and abruptly down by the big and collared AFR, thrust farther in, rhythmically in strokes that accompany each syllable in the wearily repeated in-u-til of the technical interviewer, down into Lucien's wide throat and lower, small, natal cries escaping from around the brown glazed shaft, the strangled, impeded sounds of absolute aphonia, the landed fish gasps that accompany speechlessness in a dream. The cleric-collared AFR driving the broom home now, to half its length, up to his stumps to get downward leverage, as the fibers that protect the esophageal terminus resist and then give with a crunching pop and splat of red that bathes Lucien's teeth and tongue, and makes of itself in the air a spout. And his gargled sounds now sound drowned. And behind fluttering lids the aphrasiac half-cellular insurgent billows only to sweep and dance, in a clear pane sees snow on the round hills of his native Gaspé. Pretty curls of smoke from chimneys, his mother's linen apron, her kind red face above his crib, homemade skates and cider steam, Chick-Chock lakes seen stretching away from the Kapchat hillside they skied down to mass. The red face's noises he knows from the tone are tender. Beyond crib and rimmed window, Gaspé Lake after lake after lake, lit up by the near Arctic sun and stretching out in the southeastern distance like chips of broken glass, thrown to scatter across the white Chick-Chock country, gleaming, and the river Saint-Anne a ribbon of light, unspeakably pure. And as the Colquhate handle navigates the inguinal canal and sigmoid with a queer, deep, full, hot tickle, and with a grunt and shove completes its passage and forms an obscene erectile bulge in the back of his red-sopped johns, bursting then through the wool and puncturing tile and floor, at a police lock's canted angle to hold him upright on his knees, completely skewered. And as the attentions of the AFRs in the little room are turned from him to the shelves and trunks of the entretois sad insurgents' lives, and Lucien finally dies, rather a while after he's quit shuddering like a clubbed muskie and seemed to them to die, as he finally sheds his body's suit, Lucien finds his gut and throat again, and newly whole, clean, and unimpeded, and is free, catapulted home over fans and the convexity's glass palisades at desperate speeds, soaring north, sounding a bell clear and nearly maternal alarmed call to arms in all the world's well-known tongues. Pre-dawn, the 1st of May, YDAU, outcropping northwest of Tucson, Arizona, USA. Still. M. Hugh Steepley spoke quietly, after a prolonged silence of both operatives, alone with their thoughts upon this mountain. Steepley faced, still out, standing on the outcropping's lip, bare arms around him for some warmth, his dresses soiled back to Marat. Around the bonfire, far out below upon the desert floor, rotated a ring of smaller and palsied fires, persons carrying torches or fires.
"Do you ever think of viewing it?"
Marat did not reply. It was not impossible that the young persons carrying the torches were dancing.
"Whether or not the AFR ever even recover this alleged master copy from the Duplessis burglary,"
Steepley said quietly.
"Still, you guys have a read-only copy. At least one you haven't told us, no?"
"Yes."
"Nobody has this mysterious master, but we've all got read-onlys. All the anti-ONAN cells have at least one read-only, we're pretty sure."
Marat said, "Monsieur Burim, he tells Fortier he thinks the CPCP of Alberta did not have any copy."
"Fuck the Albertans," Steepley said. "Who's worried about the Albertans? The Albertans' idea of a blow to the U.S. plexus is they blow up rangeland in Montana. They're wackos."
"I have not been tempted," Marat said.
Steepley's sound appeared as if he did not hear.
"We have more than one. Copies. Sure you can assume your boys know this."
Marat dryly laughed.
"Confiscated from Razzles of Berkeley, Boston? But who can know what is on them? Who can study the entertainment while detached?"
Steepley's scratch on the arm had become overnight puffed, and there were cross-hatches of his scratching.
"But just between us two, though, tete-a-tete, you've never been even slightly tempted? I mean, personally? You, the person? Wife's condition be damned, kids be damned, just for a second. Slip it into wherever you guys keep it and load it and have a quick look. See what's all the fuss, the irresistible pull of the thing?"
He pivoted on one heel and looked and cocked his head in a way of cynicism that seemed to Marat consummately USA. Marat coughed softly into his fist. His own dead father's Kennebec pacemaker, it had been damaged accidentally by a videophonic pulse of waves. This from a telephone call from the telephone company. A video call, advertising the videophony. And Marat had picked up the ringing phone. The videophonic pulse, it had come. And Marat had fallen, still holding a telephone Raimi had never been instructed to answer first, to check. The advertisement, which was recorded, played its audible portion out upon the floor beside his father's ear, audible between Marat's mother's cries. Steepley raised and lowered himself on his shoe's toes.
"Us? Rod the God Tyne's got Tom Flatto's I.O. boys running tests around the clock. 24-7.
Flatto, Thomas M., BSS Director of Input-Output Testing, resident of Falls Church's community,
A widower with three children. One child with cystic fibrosis.
Funny as an impacted follicle, Raimi. And no doubt the insurgent cells are all each doing work of your own, you guys with your own Dr. Brulant or whomever, trying to find out what the entertainment's appeal could be without sacrificing any of your own.
Steeply again turned. He did this for emphasis.
Or maybe you're willingly sacrificing your own, yes? Willing volunteers and chairs? Sacrificing self for the greater and all that? By adult choice and all that? Just for the sake of causing us harm? Wouldn't even want to think about how the AFR is conducting tests of the thing.
Says so.
But not so much for content, Steeply said. Input-output's exhaustive testing. Flatto's got them working on conditions and environments for possible non-lethal viewing. Certain departments in Virginia, the developing theory is that it's holography.
Die Samizdat?
The filmmaker had been a cutting-edge optics man. Holography. Diffraction. He'd used holography a couple times before, and in the context of a kind of filmed assault on the viewer. He was of the hostile school, or some such shit.
Also a maker of reflecting panels for thermal weapons. And an important annulateur, also. And a master of the capital from opticals. Before hostility and film, Marat said.
Steeply embraced himself.
Tom Flatto's personal theory is the appeal's got something to do with density, the visual compulsion. Theories that with a really sophisticated piece of holography, you'll get the neural density of an actual stage play without losing the selective realism of the viewer's screen. But the density plus the realism might be too much to take. Dick Desai, in data production, wants to go in with ALGOL and see if there are Fourier equations in the root codes ALGOL, which would signify hologrammatical activity going on.
Monsieur Fortier finds the theories of content irrelevant.
Steeply cocked his head sometimes in a way that was both feminine and bird-like. He did this most often during silences. Also, he again removed something small from his painted lip. Also, he spoke with more feminine inflection. Marat committed all this to his memories.
Winter, B.S. 1963, Sepulveda, California.
I remember I was eating lunch and reading something dull by Balzan when my father came into the kitchen and made himself a tomato juice beverage and said that as soon as I was finished, he and my mother needed my help in their bedroom.
208.
My father had spent the morning at the commercial studio and was still all in white with his wig, with its rigid white parted hair, and hadn't yet removed the television makeup that gave his real face an orange cast in daylight. I hurried up and finished and rinsed my dishes in the sink and proceeded down the hall to the master bedroom. My mother and father were both in there. The master bedroom's valance curtains and the heavy light-proof curtain behind them were all slid back and the Venetian blinds up, and the daylight was very bright in the room, the decor of which was white and blue and powder blue. My father was bent over my parents' large bed, which was stripped of bedding all the way down to the mattress protector. He was bent over, pushing down on the bed's mattress with the heels of his hands. The bed sheets and pillows and powder blue coverlet were all in a pile on the carpet next to the bed. Then my father handed me his tumbler of tomato juice to hold for him and got all the way on top of the bed and knelt on it, pressing down vigorously on the mattress with his hands and putting all his weight into it. He bore down hard on one area of the mattress, then let up and pivoted slightly on his knees and bore down with equal vigor on a different area of the mattress. He did this all over the bed, sometimes actually walking around on the mattress on his knees to get at different areas of the mattress, then bearing down on them. I remember thinking the bearing down action looked very much like emergency compression of a heart patient's chest. I remember my father's tomato juice, grains of pepperish material floating on the surface. My mother was standing at the bedroom window, smoking a long cigarette and looking at the lawn, which I had watered before I ate lunch.
The uncovered window faced south. The room blazed with sunlight.
"Eureka!"
my father said, pressing down several times on one particular spot. I asked whether I could ask what was going on.
"Goddamn bed squeaks,"
he said. He stayed on his knees over the one particular spot, bearing down on it repeatedly. There was now a squeaking sound from the mattress when he bore down on the spot. My father looked up and over at my mother next to the bedroom window.
"Do you or do you not hear that?"
he said, bearing down and letting up. My mother tapped her long cigarette into a shallow ashtray she held in her other hand. She watched my father press down on the squeaking spot. Sweat was running in dark orange lines down my father's face from under his rigid, white professional wig. My father served for 2 years as the man from GLAAD, representing what was then the GLAAD Flaccid Plastic Receptacle Company of Zanesville, Ohio, via a California-based advertising agency. The tunic, tight trousers, and boots the agency made him wear were also white. My father pivoted on his knees and swung his body around and got off the mattress and put his hand at the small of his back and straightened up, continuing to look at the mattress.
"This miserable, cock-sucking bed your mother felt she needed to hang on to and bring with us out here for, quote, sentimental value has started squeaking,"
my father said. His saying "your mother" indicated that he was addressing himself to me. He held his hand out for his tumbler of tomato juice without having to look at me. He stared darkly down at the bed.
"It's driving us fucking nuts!"
My mother balanced her cigarette in her shallow ashtray and laid the ashtray on the windowsill and bent over from the foot of the bed and bore down on the spot my father had isolated, and it squeaked again.
"And at night this one spot here we've isolated and identified seems to spread and metastasate until the whole goddamn bed's replete with squeaks."
He drank some of his tomato juice.
"Areas that gibber and squeak," my father said, "until we both feel as if we're being eaten by rats."
He felt along the line of his jaw.
"Boiling hordes of gibbering, squeaking, ravenous, rapacious rats,"
he said, almost trembling with irritation. I looked down at the mattress, at my mother's hands, which tended to flake in dry climates. She carried a small bottle of moisturizing lotion at all times. My father said,
"And I have personally had it with the aggravation."
He blotted his forehead on his white sleeve. I reminded my father that he'd mentioned needing my help with something. At that age, I was already taller than both my parents. My mother was taller than my father, even in his boots. But much of her height was in her legs. My father's body was denser and more substantial. My mother came around to my father's side of the bed and picked the bedding up off the floor. She started folding the sheets very precisely, using both arms and her chin. She stacked the folded bedding neatly on top of her dresser, which I remember was white lacquer. My father looked at me.
"What we need to do here, Jim, is take the mattress and box spring off the bed frame under here," my father said, "and expose the frame."
He took time out to explain that the bed's bottom mattress was hard-framed and known uniformly as a box spring. I was looking at my sneakers and making my feet alternately pigeon-toed and then penguin-toed on the bedroom's blue carpet. My father drank some of his tomato juice and looked down at the edge of the bed's metal frame and felt along the outline of his jaw, where his commercial studio makeup ended abruptly at the turtleneck collar of his white commercial tunic.
"The frame on this bed is old,"
he told me.
"It's probably older than you are. Right now I'm thinking the thing's bolts that maybe started coming loose, and that's what's gibbering and squeaking at night."
He finished his tomato juice and held the glass out for me to take and put somewhere.
"So, we want to move all this top crap out of the way entirely,"
he gestured with one arm.
"Entirely out of the way, get it out of the room, and expose the frame, and see if we don't maybe just need to tighten up the bolts."
I wasn't sure where to put my father's empty glass, which had juice residue and grains of pepper along the inside's sides. I poked at the mattress and box spring a little bit with my foot. "Are you sure it isn't just the mattress?" I said. The bed frame's bolts struck me as a rather exotic first-order explanation for the squeaking. My father gestured broadly.
"Synchronicity surrounds me. Concord," he said, "because that's what your mother thinks it is also."
My mother was using both hands to take the blue pillowcases off all five of their pillows, again using her chin as a clamp. The pillows were all the overplump polyester fiberfill kind because of my father's allergies.
"Great minds think alike," my father said.
Neither of my parents had any interest in hard science, though a great-uncle had accidentally electrocuted himself with a field series generator he was seeking to patent. My mother stacked the pillows on top of the neatly folded bedding on her dresser. She had to get up on her tiptoes to put the folded pillowcases on top of the pillows. I had started to move to help her, but I couldn't decide where to put the empty tomato juice glass.
"But you just want to hope it isn't the mattress," Father said, "or the box spring."
My mother sat down on the foot of the bed and got out another long cigarette and lit it. She carried a little leatherette snap case for both her cigarettes and her lighter. My father said,
"Because a new frame, even if we can't get the bolts squared away on this one, and I have to go get a new one, a new frame, it wouldn't be too bad, see? Even top-shelf bed frames aren't that expensive, but new mattresses are outrageously expensive."
He looked at my mother.
"And I mean fucking outrageous."
He looked down at the back of my mother's head.
"And we bought a new box spring for this sad excuse of a bed not 5 years ago."
He was looking down at the back of my mother's head as if he wanted to confirm that she was listening. My mother had crossed her legs and was looking with a certain concentration either at or out the master bedroom window. Our home's whole subdivision was spread along a severe hillside, which meant that the view from my parents' bedroom on the first floor was of just sky and sun and a foreshortened declivity of lawn. The lawn sloped at an average angle of 55 degrees and had to be mowed horizontally. None of the subdivision's lawns had trees yet.
"Of course, that was during a seldom-discussed point in time when your mother had to assume the burden of assuming responsibility for finances in the household,"
my father said. He was now perspiring very heavily, but still had his white professional toupee on, and still looked at my mother. My father acted, throughout our time in California, as both symbol and spokesperson for the GLAD FPR Company's Individual Sandwich Bag Division. He was the first of two actors to portray the man from GLAD. He was inserted several times a month in a mock-up of a car interior, where he would be filmed in a tight, trans-windshield shot receiving an emergency radio summons to some household that was having a portable food storage problem. He was then inserted opposite an actress in a generic kitchen interior set, where he would explain how a particular species of GLAD sandwich bag was precisely what the doctor ordered for the particular portable food storage problem at issue. In his vaguely medical uniform of all white, he carried an air of authority and great evident conviction and earned what I always gathered was an impressive salary for those times, and received, for the first time in his career, fan mail, some of which bordered on the disturbing, and which he sometimes liked to read out loud at night in the living room, loudly and dramatically, sitting up with a nightcap and fan mail long after my mother and I had gone to bed. I asked whether I could excuse myself for a moment to take my father's empty tomato juice glass out to the kitchen sink. I was worried that the residue along the inside sides of the tumbler would harden into a kind of precipitate that would be hard to wash off.
"For Christ's sakes, Jim, just put the thing down," my father said.
I put the tumbler down on the bedroom carpet over next to the base of my mother's dresser, pressing down to create a kind of circular receptacle for it in the carpet. My mother stood up and went back over to the bedroom window with her ashtray. We could tell she was getting out of our way. My father cracked his knuckles and studied the path between the bed and the bedroom door. I said I understood my part here to be to help my father move the mattress and box spring off the suspect bed frame and well out of the way. My father cracked his knuckles and replied that I was becoming almost frighteningly quick and perceptive. He went around between the foot of the bed and my mother at the window. He said,
I want to... let's just stack it all out in the hall. Get it the hell out of here and give us some room to maneuver.
Right, I said. My father and I were now on opposite sides of my parents' bed. My father rubbed his hands together and bent and worked his hands between the mattress and box spring and began to lift the mattress up from his side of the bed. When his side of the mattress had risen to the height of his shoulders, he somehow inverted his hands and began pushing his side up rather than lifting it. The top of his wig disappeared behind the rising mattress, and his side rose in an arc to almost the height of the white ceiling, exceeding 90 degrees, toppled over, and began to fall over down toward me. The mattress's overall movement was like the crest of a breaking wave, I remember. I spread my arms and took the impact of the mattress with my chest and face, supporting the angled mattress with my chest, outspread arms and face. All I could see was an extreme close-up of the woodland floral pattern of the mattress protector. The mattress, a Simmons Beauty Rest, whose tag said that it could not by law be removed, now formed the hypotenuse of a right dihedral triangle, whose legs were myself and the bed's box spring. I remember visualizing and considering this triangle. My legs were trembling under the mattress's canted weight. My father exhorted me to hold and support the mattress. The respectively sharp, plastic, and meaty human smells of the mattress and protector were very distinct because my nose was mashed up against them. My father came around to my side of the bed, and together we pushed the mattress back up until it stood at 90 degrees again. We edged carefully apart, and each took one end of the upright mattress and began jockeying it off the bed and out the bedroom door into the uncarpeted hallway. This was a king-size Simmons Beauty Rest mattress. It was massive, but had very little structural integrity. It kept curving and curling and wobbling. My father exhorted both me and the mattress. It was flaccid and floppy as we tried to jockey it. My father had an especially hard time with his half of the mattress's upright weight because of an old competitive tennis injury. While we were jockeying it on its side off the bed, part of the mattress on my father's end slipped and flopped over and down onto a pair of steel reading lamps, adjustable cubes of brushed steel attached by toggle bolts to the white wall over the head of the bed. The lamps took a solid hit from the mattress, and one cube was rotated all the way around on its toggle so that its open side and bulb now pointed at the ceiling. The joint and toggle made a painful squeaking sound as the cube was wrenched around upward. This was also when I became aware that even the reading lamps were on in the daylit room, because a faint square of direct lamplight, its four sides rendered slightly concave by the distortion of projection, appeared on the white ceiling above the skewed cube. But the lamps didn't fall off. They remained attached to the wall.
God damn it to hell,
my father said, as he regained control of his end of the mattress. My father also said,
fucking son of a...
when the mattress's thickness made it difficult for him to squeeze through the doorway still holding his end. In time, we were able to get my parents' giant mattress out in the narrow hallway that ran between the master bedroom and the kitchen. I could hear another terrible squeak from the bedroom as my mother tried to realign the reading lamp whose cube had been inverted. Drops of sweat were falling from my father's face onto his side of the mattress, darkening part of the protector's fabric. My father and I tried to lean the mattress at a slight supporting angle against one wall of the hallway, but because the floor of the hallway was uncarpeted and didn't provide sufficient resistance, the mattress wouldn't stay upright. Its bottom edge slid out from the wall all the way across the width of the hallway until it met the baseboard of the opposite wall, and the upright mattress's top edge slid down the wall until the whole mattress sagged at an extremely concave, slumped angle. A dry section of the woodland floral mattress protector stretched, drum-tight, over the slumped crease and the springs possibly damaged by the deforming concavity. My father looked at the canted concave mattress sagging across the width of the hall, and moved one end of it a little with the toe of his boot and looked at me and said, "Fuck it." My bow tie was rumpled and at an angle. My father had to walk unsteadily across the mattress in his white boots to get back to my side of the mattress and the bedroom behind me. On his way across, he stopped and felt speculatively at his jaw. His boots sunk deep in woodland floral cotton. He said, "Fuck it," again. And I remember not being clear about what he was referring to. Then my father turned and started unsteadily back the way he had come across the mattress, one hand against the wall for support. He instructed me to wait right there, in the hallway, for one moment, while he darted into the kitchen, at the other end of the hall, on a very brief errand. His steadying hand left four faint, smeared prints on the wall's white paint. My parents' bed's box spring, though also king-size and heavy, had just below its synthetic covering a wooden frame that gave the box spring structural integrity, and it didn't flop or alter its shape, and after another bit of difficulty for my father, who was too thick through the middle even with the professional girdle beneath his glad costume, after another bit of difficulty for my father squeezing with his end of the box spring through the bedroom doorway, we were able to get it into the hall and lean it vertically at something just over 70 degrees against the wall, where it stayed upright with no problem. "That's the way she wants doing, Jim," my father said, clapping me on the back in exactly the ebullient way that had prompted me to have my mother buy an elastic, athletic cranial strap for my glasses. I had told my mother I needed the strap for tennis purposes, and she had not asked any questions. My father's hand was still on my back as we returned to the master bedroom.
"Right then,"
my father said. His mood was now elevated. There was a brief second of confusion at the doorway as each of us tried to step back to let the other through first. There was now nothing but the suspect frame left where the bed had been. There was something exoskeletal and frail-looking about the bed frame, a plain, low-ratio rectangle of black steel. At each corner of the rectangle was a caster. The caster's wheels had sunk into the pile carpet under the weight of the bed and my parents, and were almost completely